Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, everyone, please. And welcome back to the third hearing today in the Supreme Court of the State of Idaho. Hearing in the case of Title State versus Ish, case number 49412. This matter, Martin Ish Fields, represented by Sally Cooley, and the state is the respondent, represented by Ken Ferguson. Counsel, are there any preliminary matters we need to address before our meeting?
Yeah, Your Honor.
There you are. Well then, Ms. Cooley, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. In 2009, I bounced was found mortally wounded in the parking lot of the bar where he worked. The search for the perpetrator went cold until 2015. That year, new evidence surfaced and Martin Ish was charged and tried for the second degree murder of Lauren Red Elk. Mr. Ish was tried and convicted of voluntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 15 years with 10 years fixed. This court reversed that conviction, finding his right and the juror's right equal protection of a non-discriminatory jury selection process were violated under Batson v. Kentucky. Mr. Ish is half Native American and half Black. Mr. Ish was tried a second time and found guilty. And on appeal, we've raised four constitutional violations. His constitutional right to a speedy trial was violated by holding him for 15 months without trial, where the court incorrectly calculated the length of the delay. The motion to change venue was improperly denied, despite the prosecutor and defense counsel stipulating to a change in venue due to pre-trial publicity in the small community in which the event occurred. The court erred by denying the motion to strike for a cause a prospective juror who was employed as a probation officer in Bannock County. And finally, after Mr. Ish won his appeal, and this court found discriminatory jury selection processes, after retrial, Judge Carnaroli increased the sentence by 4 years without giving a reason, chilling the exercise of basic constitutional rights. Unless this court has questions regarding the venue and probation officer juror issues, I will discuss the peace speedy trial and vindictive sentencing issues today. Now, the U.S. Constitution provides that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial. The Idaho Constitution is similar and uses the same analysis as the federal Constitution. This is analyzed under Barker v. Wingo. It's analyzed on a case-by-case basis, depends on the unique facts of each case. And the Barker Court uses the ad hoc approach, taking into consideration four factors: the length of the delay, the reasons for the delay, the defendant's assertion of his right, and the prejudice suffered by the defendant owing to the delay. Now, this 15-month delay was presumptively prejudicial. It's sufficient to trigger further inquiry. Mr. Ish was taken into custody on this charge on April 15, 2020, but was not brought to trial until July 27, 2021, a delay of 15 months. The second factor to be considered is the reason for the delay.
So just so I'm clear, counsel, the initiating date for measuring speedy trial should be what day then? Should it be the day remitted or issued for the prior appeal, or is there another date you're looking at?
I'm looking at the date he was actually transported to Bannock County and a bond was set on him. That was the April 15, 2020 date. The next factor to be considered is the reason for the delay. Here we have multiple reasons. And the first reason would be that this court issued COVID-19 orders suspending jury trials during the pandemic, during the infectious disease for that reason. So the jury trials were suspended. However, the district court, in calculating the effect of these orders on its calculations for speedy trial, it erred. Instead of using just a straight up Barker v. Wingo, where it would just calculate it out as being a more neutral reason, or Barker v. Wingo, of course, with respect to the delays attributable to the government, different weights are assigned to different reason. You know, a deliberate attempt to delay the trial in order to hamper the defense is weighed heavily against the government, whereas this reason, which is a more neutral reason, it's similar to negligence or overcrowded courts, those are weighed less heavily, but nevertheless should be considered, since the ultimate responsibility for such circumstances must rest with the government rather than with the defendant.
Let me ask you about that, where the COVID-19 precautions were implemented for the safety of everyone, including your client. And especially given the record that your client had contracted COVID-19 and suffered complications as a result, why doesn't the suspension of trials for purposes of preventing the spread of COVID-19 constitute a legitimate reason rather than a neutral?
And Your Honor, it is still a neutral reason. As the United States Supreme Court recently recognized in Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn v. Como, government is not free to disregard the Constitution in times of crisis. And even in a pandemic, the Constitution cannot be put away and forgotten. For that reason, it's a more neutral reason. Overcrowded courts, a pandemic with orders suspending jury trials, those are reasons that are more neutral. They're not completely subtracted. And in this case, the court...
And so, hold on, was the Roman Diocese case, was that a speedy trial case?
Your Honor, that was not a speedy trial case. That was a case involving the New York governor putting different levels of, opening and capacity on different businesses throughout the city of New York during the COVID pandemic. And so the Roman Catholic Diocese, of course, they were aggrieved because their facilities capacity, you know, how many parishioners would be allowed inside the church was definitely affected. And they had, you know, issues with that. And the problem was that some other businesses, such as, liquor stores, allowed a greater capacity. And the church was aggrieved because of that. And the United States Supreme Court found that, you know, in making these quotes, government's not free to disregard the Constitution in times of crisis. They said that these parameters, the local government had placed, were improper and were too restrictive, and they were restricting the exercise of religion in that case.
So I don't know that we're dealing with an argument here unless you're making an argument that this court disregarded the Constitution in passing the COVID restrictions. Are you arguing that?
Your Honor, I'm not arguing that this court disregarded the Constitution. I'm saying that this still counts as a factor, a neutral factor. It's not a nothing. It's not something that can simply be subtracted. And so in this case, the district court did simply subtract all the time that the orders were in effect. It removed it from its calculations, which is an improper calculation. The proper calculation would have been to leave it in and consider this was a 15-month delay, not try and subtract out the periods of time when the court had ordered not to have trials.
Well, in fact, and in fairness to the district court, I think this court's orders actually said that the time of the suspension of the jury trials during this period, that it did not count against speedy.
Yeah, yes, and Your Honor, I do think that is, while it may be consistent with the orders, I think that was beyond the reach of the court, and it should not have been. It should still enter into the calculus. Similar to an overcrowded court system, it's a neutral factor. It should still remain in the calculus. In this case, the judge erred because he subtracted out that calculation entirely, and also I think used more of a speedy trial act, the federal calculation in making his determinations. He didn't do the entirety of the Barker v. Wingo test. He just stopped once he found that he was not within 180 days, which was just erroneous math, essentially.
And so I want to come back to my original question, which was, even if we include it in the time frame and we say, all right, we're measuring the length of the delay, we're going to look at 15 months, why are these precautions that were instituted for the protection of your client as well as others, why are those not a legitimate or good cause for the delay? Why are they neutral? Because I'm not seeing how the Roman Diocese case applies to say it's a neutral factor under Barker v. Wingo.
Your Honor, just because an overcrowded court or a closed court, that's still a neutral factor. It's not an impossibility. It's an improbability, you know. And besides, further, because there were periods of time where this court did not have suspended the jury trials, and the court could have held the hearings on those dates. There were, I think, 56 days in which the court were permitted to be open and were permitted to have jury trials with certain precautions. And Mr. Ish did not receive his trial within that period of days either. I think the district court erred by removing entirely the calculus. I still think it's a neutral factor. Additional reasons for delay beyond the COVID-19 factors were the state's 2-month delay because their witnesses were inconvenienced and not able to travel or not wanting to travel at the time. And then the court had its own planned scheduled vacation that delayed the trial by about 67 days, in addition to some unprepared juror questionnaires and a lack of the correct number of jurors brought in.
And then those, all three of those last ones happened together, right? I mean, I just want to clarify, the district court didn't take a vacation for 67 days. It rescheduled the trial and said, I'm doing it for three reasons.
Yes.
Jury questionnaires, not a large enough veneer. And as I read his order, and correct me if I'm wrong, he says, because we're not going to be ready to go due to the first two, I have a vacation planned and I'm going to take that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's an accurate recitation. And I don't have any information about how long the vacation actually was. I do know that from the date he reset it, it was out another 67 days. And so that would be the count for the delay.
Well, we also know another jury trial took place at the same time that was supposed to take place that was presided over by another judge. Do we know anything about that trial and why that was given priority to this one?
Your Honor, I don't know a lot about that trial. I do know, I think they said on the record that that person had been incarcerated for a longer period of time than Mr. Ish. Although that does seem a little bit incredible to me because Mr. Ish was incarcerated for so long. But I think that was the reason that they set that one first.
You agree that would be appropriate if those facts were true?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I do think that it is important that they take the speedy, you know, I think whoever's been incarcerated for longer, you know, with the charge and everything leading up to it, you know, that would be important. Yes.
Well, the reality is due to the fact we had to suspend or we decided to suspend jury trials due to COVID to protect the public, protect court staff, protect litigants, there were a number of criminal defendants who were incarcerated who were waiting for trials, right? So when jury trials resume, it's trying to figure out in what order are they going to go, right?
Absolutely. Yes. And that once again, we're back in the neutral factor, negligence, overcrowded courts. That's all a factor here. You know, the courts, I think, for the most part, did a good job in making sure that the priority defendants, the ones who had been incarcerated for longer, whose speedy trial rights were up or were about to expire, were placed in line first. But yes, there was quite a backlog of cases to be heard, trials to be held.
And before you move on, I just want to clarify, did I read your brief? I want to make sure if we deduct, and I agree, I concede you don't agree that the amount of time due to COVID should be deducted from the delay. But if we deduct it, do I read your brief to say we had 204 days that he waited before he went to trial a second time?
Your Honor, I believe that's correct. And that may be, yes, that should be the correct date if the court seems fit to remove that. But once again, I think that's a neutral factor that's still included in the analysis. And then the third factor is how and whether the defendant asserted his right to a speedy trial. And I don't think there's any dispute here. Mr. Ish asserted his right to a speedy trial pretty much every juncture when we were talking about trial dates. And that's the words of the district court in this case. And then prejudice as a result of the delay. You know, he was incarcerated during COVID. That was a very scary time for inmates. They were imprisoned and in a densely populated area. Mr. Ish did contract COVID. And I think, as you mentioned, he did have complications. He was hospitalized for it. He had to have ongoing medication, which the jail apparently didn't have available to him. And so because of that, the Barker factors, when taken as a whole, necessitate a finding that his speedy trial right was violated and dismissal is appropriate.
Do we have to equally weigh each of the Barker factors, or does the weight given to the factors differ depending on the factual circumstances of the case?
My understanding of Barker v. Wingo is it is an ad hoc approach. It depends on the facts and the unique circumstances of each case. I don't believe they're weighed equally. I think that the court looks at the whole picture there and what happened and at each of the four stages that Barker v. Wingo would be. And then I'd like to move on to the vindictive sentencing. By sentencing Mr. Ish to 4 more years in prison, the court sent a message: don't appeal. The appearance of vindictiveness. You challenge a racially discriminatory practice that happened during your trial, your sentence will be increased upon retrial. And that's what happened here. Mr. Ish's rights were chilled. Under North Carolina v. Pierce, the United States Supreme Court has provided due process of law required vindictiveness against a defendant for having successfully attacked his first conviction must play no part in the sentence he receives after a new trial. And the fear of such vindictiveness may unconstitutionally deter a defendant's exercise of the right to appeal or collaterally attack his first conviction. Due process requires a defendant be freed of apprehension of such a retaliatory motivation on the part of the sentencing judge. And here, Judge Carnaroli increased the sentence by 4 years and did not provide any basis for doing so. He did not provide reasoning in the trial, you know, things that happened at trial that the court deemed more egregious. He did not provide reasons that contained, or, you know, maybe Mr. Ish's criminal history was more available to him. He provided no reasons that he increased the sentence by 4 years fixed. So where Mr. Ish would be eligible for parole next year around June, instead he must serve, and that would be under the original sentence. Now, because he appealed, prevailed on his appeal, and had a retrial, he's going to be incarcerated until 2029.
Well, and I want to be clear, you're applying a legal presumption when you make that statement, right? There's no evidence in the record that Judge Carnaroli actually imposed this sentence to penalize Mr. Ish, is there? You're asking us to apply a legal presumption.
Your Honor, the term vindictive is a legal term of art. It doesn't imply or mean malice in this case. It's just a presumption of vindictiveness, occurs when the sentence is increased after the right to appeal is exercised.
And from a practical perspective, where Judge Carnaroli didn't preside over the first trial and he didn't craft the sentence that was imposed after the first trial, how is he supposed to explain why he's deviating from that sentence? He didn't see the evidence in the first trial, and he can't get into the first district judge's mind to know why he imposed the sentence he did. So this brings us right to the separate sentencers argument. I don't know why we would presume retaliation when, from a practical perspective, he can't explain why he's imposing a more harsh sentence other than to give his reasons on the record for why he sentenced the way he did. And he did that, didn't he? He explained his sentence.
Your Honor, he did explain his sentence. He talked about the deterrence in the community, although he did recognize that Mr. Ish had been incarcerated this entire time. There had been apparently an increase in violence in the community. However, Mr. Ish could not have been responsible for that, as he was incarcerated during this time that he was between the first and second trials. To back up a little bit here, Judge Carnaroli did hear and make a sentencing decision. Judge Carnaroli heard the Rule 35 motion for leniency, in which a Rule 35 functions as a review of the underlying sentence. And Judge Carnaroli did a good job here in looking through. He looked through what he described as Judge Nye's record of the trial. So I'm presuming he looked through the record, the clerk's file, the court's file. And then he reviewed the PSI as well. Upon looking at these items, he said that the sentence appears appropriate following the review of the record conducted by Judge Nye, record of the trial conducted by Judge Nye, and the defendant's pre-sentence investigation report. Now, the Pierce presumption was, I guess, modified or explained or guardrails were put on it a little bit in Texas v. McCullough, a case that was maybe 10 years later. And so in Texas v. McCullough, I think we have precisely the situation here. So in Texas v. McCullough, the presumption of vindictiveness is inapplicable when different sentencers assess the varying sentences. Here we have the same sentencer assessing both sentences. In assessing the Rule 35, he looked through everything, he evaluated everything, he evaluated the sentence, and he made his determination.
Well, let's be clear what that determination was.
Abuse of discretion.
I'm going a little bit different. Rule 35, he's determining would I impose a lesser sentence, right? He's not saying this is the sentence I would impose. Rule 35 doesn't allow him to go up, right?
Accurate, yes.
And so when we talk about the determination he made on the Rule 35 motion, all he was saying is I wouldn't have imposed a lesser sentence. He didn't speak at all to whether had he been the original sentencer, he may have gone up.
Your Honor, that is correct. He did not speak that way. However, instead of saying this sentence is adequate or I would not have imposed a lesser sentence, he said the 15-year length of the sentence, the fixed term of 10 years, and the indeterminate term of 5 years appear appropriate to this court following its review. He's saying the sentence is appropriate. He's not just saying I'm not going to change it, I'm not going to lower it. He said it's appropriate.
Except he's reviewing appropriate in terms of should it be less. That's my struggle, is his review is constrained on a Rule 35 motion. So I understand the interpretation you're giving the language, but why isn't it just as reasonable to interpret that language as he's saying, I'm not going to go down because this works as is?
Your Honor, I think we're just stuck with the language he used here, but I do read appropriate to mean that the sentence appears appropriate. It appears appropriate after his thorough review of the record in front of Judge Nye and the pre-sentence investigation report. And he could have certainly, had he justified this sentence, we wouldn't be in this presumption here. Had he justified it with additional facts or evidence, or maybe the pre-sentence investigation uncovered a new crime or something along those lines, that would certainly justify an increased sentence. Pierce doesn't put such parameters that no judge can ever increase a sentence upon retrial ever, but it's simply saying that a presumption of vindictiveness appears, and this is going to chill defendants' rights. What defendant would want to appeal if there's a chance they're going to be resentenced to a harsher penalty? And I see I'm out of time here. If I can reserve the remainder of my time.
Well, thank you.
At least the court. I understand there were some technical difficulties earlier today, and I have been told I can yell at the court. I will try to speak up. I'm not yelling at the court, of course. I'm just trying to make sure that everything gets on the record. The two issues that have been addressed in this oral argument have to do with speedy trial and vindictive sentencing. In relation to the speedy trial issue, I suppose it's probably a little bit too early for the state to ask this court to review what it did in Lankford. So I will go within the parameters of what this court did say in Lankford. First off, it did apply the speedy trial rights after the initial trial. The question I have in relation to Lankford is how it applies in that. I mean, we know that it's well-established law that we go at the arrest date or the charging date is normally when we start the speedy trial running. So I guess the question immediately becomes, is everything that came before the remediator irrelevant to this analysis at this point? And I think like Lankford kind of suggests it does, but one of the things that the state has asked this court to look at is the fact that he waived his speedy trial rights before his first trial. Does that waiver carry over? Does that waiver somehow restore are his rights restored simply because he's had a reversal on appeal and now wants a speedy retrial after the reversal of his initial trial? I would submit that waiver cannot be ignored. It either is still applicable or at least it is entitled to some consideration on prong three of the Barker test. So if this court reaches the Barker test, there are, of course, the four prongs, and counsel has argued that it was the date in which he was sent back. I won't really quibble with that, but the remitter date seems to be a little bit more applicable if we're starting over, because that's when his reversal actually became official. So we're talking about a May 8th, 2020 remitter and a July 27, 2021 trial, about 15 months. That is not an overly long time, even under the circumstances of this case, even setting aside reasons for delay. We're talking about a multi-day trial on a homicide. We're talking about marshaling a great deal of evidence. We're talking about probably in more needs of time for preparation than your average garden variety trial in a criminal context. So 15 months, although it might sort of cross that threshold for the time frame where we get that presumption, it is entitled to minimal weight. Second off, the reason for delay, and I think that this is the main thrust of appellant's argument, and of course, counsel has accurately set forth the test. There are basically three categories in relation to reason for delay. There's deliberate delay, where the state is attempting to delay for tactical or strategic reasons. And of course, that level of delay is not at issue in this case. Nobody's ever claimed it. Nobody's ever demonstrated it. It's simply not an issue. Then there are neutral reasons. These usually include things like negligence, or an overcrowded docket, things that are within a certain amount of control of the court system, of the prosecutor, of the defense, those sorts of things. And then there's the valid reasons, such as witness unavailability. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether having safety precautions from COVID are equivalent to negligence or code overcrowding, or whether they're more like witness availability, where you just simply cannot have the trial because you can't get the witnesses there for the trial. And as Justice Brody pointed out, this court's order suspending trials during periods of pandemic when it was at its height indicated that this falls into the third category. I would submit that the order is correct. These steps taken in relation to safety, I don't know how it would have been different if a meteor had struck the Bennett County Courthouse and we're trying to find a different way to conduct trials. The pandemic was obviously beyond anybody's control, and the response to that was a reasonable, necessary response, not negligence, not overcrowding of dockets, but a necessary safety precaution. So the district court did correctly put that in the valid reasons for delay. On top of that, even if this were moved up, even if the COVID delays were moved up to the neutral factors, again, we're only talking about 15 months, which for a type of trial like this isn't an extensive delay for the preparation. So even if it goes into the neutral category, this still weighs in favor of finding no violation of speedy trial rights. Then there's the assertion of the right. Now, it's true that Mr. Ish did assert his speedy trial rights after the remitter, but as we know, he was perfectly willing to waive them the first time around. So there hasn't been a consistent assertion of speedy trial rights. There has been a tactical assertion of speedy trial rights. And then finally, in prejudice, we have two types of prejudice. We have the prejudice that comes from prejudice attached to the trial, and we have prejudice that comes from the natural prejudice of being accused of a crime, perhaps being in custody, all of those things. It's this latter category that we're dealing with here. And while I don't want to in any way minimize that type of prejudice, we know it gets much less weight than the type of prejudice that would actually affect the fairness of the trial.
I want to return to your waiver argument for a moment. I'm just trying to determine how far to take that. If for some reason we conclude that a decision made at the beginning of the first trial should also be applicable to the second trial, how far do we take that? If the defendant didn't object to certain evidence in the first trial, is he still free to object to it in the second trial?
It seems
to me they're two different trials, and they should be able to make independent decisions both times.
Well, clearly that's the case in the evidence, but I would submit that this isn't akin to that situation. There are other aspects of this other than speedy trial. There are certain due process considerations that can be brought into view. So a waiver of speedy trial doesn't mean that you have opened yourself up to the state abusing the process, for example. But we're far short of that. We're way short of that. There's no evidence whatsoever that the state is abusing the process. So even with a speedy trial right, a defendant isn't without certain ability to ask the court and to get a trial within a reasonable amount of time.
So you said it was something that's not controlling but provided some weight?
The waiver?
Yeah.
I'm saying both. I'm saying it's controlling.
Let's assume we don't buy the waiver argument, but we do decide to consider how much weight to give that. Why should it be entitled to substantial weight?
I'm only assuming that for purposes of this argument, of course. I don't know how you undo a waiver later. I don't know why just the fact of a trial and appeal would undo a waiver. If he waived it before an initial trial setting, just right after the preliminary hearing, and then a year later said, you know what, the waiver wasn't really a good idea. This has dragged out longer than I anticipated when I waived it. Can I reinstate my speedy trial rights? You, of course, wouldn't allow that.
Typically, the reason there's a second trial is because there was a problem with the first trial.
Yes.
It wasn't the defendant's fault. Typically, Correct. It was a mistake made by the prosecution or by the judge.
Absolutely.
So why should that be held against the defendant in the second trial? Why doesn't he get a do-over since he wasn't the one that messed up the first one?
Well, as I understand what you're saying here, is why isn't there some sort of estoppel analysis that would prevent the state from asserting the waiver?
Nicer than do-over, yes.
Well, it sounds more legal because it's Latin or something. But one of the two. It's all Greek to me. Anyway, the point being that should there be something that would relieve the defendant of his waiver, and I would submit that going through the normal processes of an appeal to evaluate the fairness of the trial is not that process. It is not something that rises to an estoppel level. It is not something that rises to the level of forgiving the waiver, of nullifying the waiver, of making it somehow null and void or unenforceable. Even if, and again, assuming for purposes of this argument that, okay, your waiver is no longer enforceable, your speedy trial rights have been restored to you just by virtue of having prevailed on appeal.
And my struggle, though, is two trials, two waivers. I mean, why isn't it that simple? I understand, and that's more rhetorical. I understand why you're arguing what you're arguing, but that's my struggle. They're two separate trials. This isn't the hypothetical you posed earlier, which is I waived at the beginning and now this is going on too long and I haven't had my trial and I'm going to invoke. But they're two separate trials, and I'm struggling with why, when he is sent back to have an entirely new trial, why doesn't he get a new speedy trial right?
Well, because first off, when we look, you know, kind of going back to the whole Lankford thing, which the state lost, and I'm trying to be a good loser, if we say that there is a speedy trial right that somehow applies on the remediator and applies to the trial, I'm not sure where we draw the line in terms of what invalidates a waiver. What if the district court had granted the Batson motion initially? Does that restore the waiver? And now the next thing he gets to do is, after the mistrial is declared, does he get to then say, by the way, my speedy trial rights, I'm reasserting those now?
No, I mean, it strikes me the duration of the waiver is until the jury issues the verdict in the trial. He's gotten his trial at that point. He waived his right to this speedy trial. Trial's done. We're done. Anything that happens after that, orders a new trial, starts the speedy trial right over.
And I think that goes to the fundamental problem with Lankford, is that it's really charting uncharted territory about restarting the whole thing. If it does restart the whole thing, if we just ignore everything that happened before, then that might be the right analysis. If we are ignoring the date of his arrest, if we're ignoring all of that time frame up to the date of the remediator or the transportation back, then it does make sense to ignore the waiver also. However, I would submit that if he's not really interested in being brought to trial, the first trial happened about 5 years after his initial arrest. And if he's okay with waiting 5 years for a trial, I'm not sure why getting a trial within 12 months or some other figure that wouldn't have triggered the presumption is necessarily just where we're starting at as our baseline. Of course, if that is the baseline, if everything that went on beforehand suddenly doesn't matter, then I guess the state takes the good with the bad. The 5 years don't count. Therefore, any waiver that occurred in the 5 years doesn't count. I think that that's giving a little bit lesser weight than a waiver is entitled to. He didn't waive his rights for a particular thing. He didn't waive it until we get a jury verdict. He waived it. It was an absolute waiver. So, if this court does say, as it apparently did in Lankford, that the rights start over and therefore nothing that happened beforehand happened, then I guess the waiver doesn't matter. But again, the state is arguing in this case, and I'm asserting to this court, that I'm a little concerned about where that analysis ultimately leads.
I just wonder if we're overthinking this. I mean, if we look at the remand, if we look at the language in Ish 1, at the end of the decision, it says we remand this matter for a new trial. Shouldn't we just focus on the word new trial? Wouldn't a new trial suggest that everyone starts over and that we judge things from that point? It's not being remanded for a continued trial or for trial part two. It's not a sequel in that sense. It's a new trial.
Well, it is a new trial. I guess if we say there's a right to a speedy new trial, then there's the question of how that right applies and where it applies. And again, I still think that that comes down to, do we consider anything that happened prior to that remediator, or are we considering this as some brand new right that now attaches to new trials as opposed to, you know, the right to speedy new trials as opposed to just the right to speedy trials? And if that's what this court says, then we do start all over. But I'm not sure how that analysis would apply to other aspects in relation to all of this. We know that, you know, you get new evidentiary rulings, but does that mean that nothing that happened before matters?
What if we remanded a case for ineffective assistance of counsel? Wouldn't that be a case where we would certainly want to do a complete start over?
Well, not necessarily. It would depend on what counsel is ineffective for.
Waiving a speedy trial.
Well, if counsel is found ineffective for waiving speedy trial, then of course you reinstate the speedy trial right. I mean, that was the improperly waived right. But the waiver went up. Nobody contested the waiver. Nobody said his speedy trial rights were violated. So I have reservations about the idea of how far we take this. Nothing that happened before the remediator matters. So regardless of the waiver, however, even if the assertion of the right goes in his favor, because he did clearly assert it repeatedly after the remediator, he asserted it basically from the very first hearing. We are not contesting that aspect of it. And then finally, I've already covered the prejudice prong. We went back. That confused me for a minute. So ultimately, when you look at the balancing factors, there is no speedy trial violation. The length was reasonable, even if it was a little bit longer than would be such that wouldn't start the speedy trial analysis. The reason for the delay was valid. Even if it wasn't valid, it was neutral. The assertion of the right does weigh in favor. Prejudice weighs minimally in favor. All of these things together demonstrate that the court acted reasonably in scheduling this trial, was respectful of Mr. Ish's speedy trial rights, and ultimately he did obtain the new trial in a relatively expeditious manner, given all of the circumstances that were the district court confronted. As to vindictive sentencing.
Before you go there,
yes.
Just address the remedy for a moment. So if we were to find that there was a violation here, Mr. Ish argues that it results in a dismissal in this case. Speak to that issue, please.
I believe that that's correct. I believe that the remedy for a speedy trial violation is dismissal with prejudice. As to the vindictive prosecution, it's a little bit unusual from a lot of things that we end up discussing in law, simply because what we're talking about ultimately is vindictive motivation. In other words, was the underlying motivation vindictiveness, punitive, or is the underlying motivation something else? And so, first off, we do have a presumption that can arise merely from the fact of a higher sentence than the previous sentence. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has very clearly said that we do not apply that presumption where it makes no sense to apply it, such as if you have a different judge, Why would a different judge be presumed to be acting punitively toward a defendant when that judge was not found in error, when that judge had nothing to do whatsoever with the original sentence? And that applies. And ultimately, once that happens, there has to be something in the record that would suggest. Once you get rid of the presumption, it works like standard presumptions do. Is it rebuttable? Yes. Was there any attempt to rebut it? In this case, if there is no presumption, there was no attempt to rebut it. There was nothing else presented that would suggest retaliatory motivation other than the fact of the sentence itself. And quite a bit of Ish's argument depends on the idea that there's kind of only one reasonable sentence at issue here, and that's the first one. Because when the U.S. Supreme Court looks at this, it recognized different sentencing judges are going to look at the exact same evidence, the exact same circumstances, and they might reach different conclusions. That's one of the reasons why this court has such a broad abuse of discretion in sentencing review. This court doesn't look at a sentence and say, is this the sentence I would have given? And then, therefore, all other sentences are unreasonable. It looks at a sentence and says, no, could a reasonable jurist have concluded that this is a reasonable sentence? And here we have a difference of 4 years fixed. Could a reasonable juror look at this and say 10 years fixed is reasonable? Yes. Could a reasonable juror look at this and say 14 years fixed is reasonable? Yes. Then why would we presume out of that that the extra 4 years were the result of a improper motivation? There is no presumption, and there is nothing in this record that suggests an improper motivation. And oh, by the way, even if there were, even the presumption can be rebutted through evidence that the district court was motivated by something else. And that is not.
Oh, let's get to that point.
That is that, and unlike counsel has represented today, that is not only new evidence or changed circumstances. The fact that we have a different sentencer alone suggests otherwise. And also, this district court specifically said, I have evaluated this evidence independently of any prior evaluation of the evidence and reached an independent conclusion.
Assuming we find the presumption applies, and then we're rebutting it here, we can look at what Judge Carnarelli said at sentencing.
Yes.
One of his comments was that the prior judge looked at a similar pre-sentence investigation, similar testimony.
Yes.
So that suggests that he was aware of what the prior pre-sentence investigation said. He was also aware of what the prior testimony was, or he wouldn't have said it was similar.
Yes.
So absent him pointing out how there's something more aggravating, why does that how does that rebut the presumption?
Well, I think it rebuts the presumption simply because the judge is saying, I'm taking an independent review of it. And so as the U.S. Supreme Court said, an independent review is what we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to achieve an independent review, one unmotivated by vindictiveness. And so if there is no suggestion of vindictiveness, and we have a judge saying, I am doing this based upon an independent review. Now,
is this enough that this is what Judge Carnarelli said? He said it was the same, similar testimony, similar PSI, but I have to make my own mind uninfluenced by what Judge Nine did.
Yes.
Is that all that's required?
Yes, under the circumstances. Now, I think we would have a very different circumstance if we had the same sentencing judge saying, I'm looking at similar evidence and reaching a different conclusion. That's why we have the presumption. But if we have an independent judge saying, I'm conducting an independent review of this evidence and making an independent decision, that does rebut the idea that the judge is employing vindictive motivation.
Is the magnitude of the discrepancy at all a factor? I know we talked about all was just 4 years, but I mean, that was 40% longer. 4 years, that's how long we're in high school. That's how long we're in college, some of us longer. But point is this was a pretty substantial variance from the first decision without any explanation, other than I just feel it should be higher.
Well, it kind of was, but by the same token, yes, you know, first off, we're not talking about something as drastic as might be imagined. And I think one of the U.S. Supreme Court cases was talking about a period of months in relation to a minor crime. So, yes, I think that the scope of the discrepancy is relevant, but it's certainly not controlling. And so, you know, 4 years, both judges thought 15 years was appropriate. Both of them thought the maximum 15 years is appropriate here. The only difference is one judge thought, well, I want you to be basically on probation or parole for 5 years, or to be eligible for parole for that 5 years. And the other one said, no, I do not believe that parole is necessarily appropriate in this. What I want is a 1 year to facilitate your release into the community, but not necessarily a lengthy period of parole for that.
So the fixed portion of a sentence typically is intended for punishment.
Yes.
And to protect society.
Yes.
Shouldn't there have been some reason why those extra four? Look, I sentence a lot of people to long prison terms in my life. Some of the others of us have done that as well. But I'm not so callous as to say 4 years is a lot longer sentence. That's a long time, especially where the tail on this is only going to be 1 year now instead of 5 years. So virtually no meaningful parole. They'll only have a chance for parole in this last year. Given that the fixed sentence is for punishment or protection, shouldn't something have been said about those things that suggest why extra time was necessary?
Well, I don't think anything more specific than what the district court did, which is say, I have reached this independent of the prior sentencing. So does the court have to say, I find that you are more dangerous to society than the prior judge did? How could he even conclude that? I'm not sure exactly what sort of thing you're looking for here as far as what a judge could say to suggest that. I've independently evaluated this defendant's risk of harm to society and the need to protect society. I have independently evaluated the need for punishment. I don't know how the judge then makes the next step and says, I have concluded differently than the prior judge. That's obvious. So I'm not sure what the judge would say other than I have reached these decisions based upon my own independent review of the evidence and the application of the law to the evidence. That is pretty much a straight out statement that I'm not doing this vindictively.
Well, and there was more than that, right?
Yes.
More than I am making an independent decision. He talks about Mr. Ish's criminal history. He's multiple offender. He says, I think professional criminal comes from, you know, Two Hill and it's applicable. You took a life. So, I mean, he walks through a variety of factors in explaining why he's determined this is the appropriate sentence.
That's exactly right. And I think that where the difference of the parties actually comes down to is, can that judge point to something in the record and say, this is evidence different than the last judge considered? And that's where I think the argument breaks down. Because the U.S. Supreme Court has never said that. It has said the opposite. It has said that once an independent judge makes an independent evaluation, we're done with the analysis. We can conclude that that was not vindictive. So the whole idea that something had to be different, the evidence had to be different. Well, we know it was different. We know it was the current PSI was similar to the prior PSI. We know that the evidence considered was similar. And one other difference is, of course, well, you know, this judge then sat through the trial. And again, the evidence was probably similar, but I would be surprised if it was exactly the same.
Before you run out of time, I know it wasn't brought up by the appellate, but could you address the issue concerning juror number three? certainly I understand the discretion that's involved in determining whether or not a probation officer that works with an agency can sit on a trial, jury trial, in which that agency is involved. But I'm more concerned about the second ruling. The judge had a second chance on this, and this is when evidence came up that this juror had a personal relationship with the husband of one of the key witnesses and knew that witness because of that relationship, and had been to their home. It seems to me that the second information that came to the judge should have pushed it over into a challenge for accommodate exception.
I have 46 seconds remaining. May I
answer the question?
Thank you.
You need a little more time. You have it.
Thank you. Well, I want to go back to the basics because we're talking about two types of bias. The first one is implied and the second is actual. The implied bias still has no effect under that scenario. The implied bias is statutory, and what it says is under certain circumstances, we just deem this person biased. There is nothing they can do to convince us they are not. On the actual bias standard, I would first off point out that my recollection is that second ruling isn't actually challenged on appeal, but I would defer to this court's reading of the appellant's brief as to whether that's true. As to the actual bias, then the question becomes, okay, this probation officer apparently supervised somebody, that somebody had a wife or a significant other that he encountered and met, but still assured that, you know, my knowledge of that witness won't affect anything here. And I think that one of the questions that immediately pops into my mind is if I'm the prosecutor and the probation officer says, I'm familiar with one of the state civilian witnesses, I'm thinking, oh no, maybe I want to be making the motion. So, you know, there's really nothing here that would suggest that the knowledge of the witness, the familiarity with the witness, would have influenced the probation officer's view of the case. And I don't recall from the record whether we really have anything, even whether the probation officer thought that this person would be more or less credible based upon familiarity with her. So I just don't think that there's enough in this record to show error by the trial court in saying, no, familiarity with the witness does bias does create actual bias in this jury. Thank you
very much, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I just to address a little bit of opposing counsel's argument regarding the no new speedy trial right once you've waived it in the first trial. I would just like to say that when this court ordered a new trial, Mr. Ish was entitled to all the constitutional rights attendant to a trial. This court should probably deny the state's motion for rehearing Langford. And then I would also add that, you know, regarding the discussion of vindictiveness, and, you know, Texas v. McCullough, the presumption of vindictiveness is inapplicable when different sentencers assess the varying sentences. What we have here is this judge, Judge Canaroli, assessed both of the sentences. He imposed the second sentence after the second trial. And that the purpose of Pierce is to protect against chilling effect. And here we have a court that has no additional reason for imposing 4 more years fixed, which is a substantial period of time, as Justice Mueller pointed out. And the district court's words that they conducted an independent review, that's no consolation to Mr. Ish, who's in prison for an additional 4 years.
But do you agree with the respondent's argument that this presumption doesn't apply when it's a new judge sentencing as opposed to the prior judge sentencing and giving up harsher sentence?
Your Honor, the words of Texas v. McCullough, the United States Supreme Court's decision in 1986, in which they, you know, put some guardrails on Pierce, the Pierce presumption, That quote is, the presumption of vindictiveness is inapplicable when different sentencers assess the varying sentences. And here we have precisely the situation that is describing. Judge Conaroli assessed the sentence when he reviewed all of that information from the first trial and reviewed the PSI. He assessed the sentence. He found the sentence was appropriate. He wrote the sentence was appropriate in his order denying the Rule 35 motion. And then he came back and he heard the same information as this court noted. We looked through the pretty much the same information. He heard the same, pretty much the same information at trial, the same information in the PSI, and he imposed a greater sentence, a sentence greater by 4 years fixed, which is a substantial period of time and most certainly has a chilling effect on Mr. Ish and those in his position. Other prisoners, other defendants, they're going to hesitate to appeal because of this. We'd ask the court to dismiss this case ultimately because of the speedy trial violation, but if the court chooses not to do that, at least remand this case, or provided there are instructions to make the sentence conform with the first sentence that he received in 2017, the 15 years with 10 years.
Very much. Counsel, each of you, we appreciate the fine argument today, the opportunity to engage with you. Standards under advisement for render decision. Thank you all again for coming.